Evening Under Lamplight on Cambridge 105 Radio.
Here is a special announcement. Today is Tuesday, and not, as is announced in today's Sunday Telegraph, Friday. And now, a repeat of last Thursday's performance of Monday Night is Music Night.
Back with Evening Under Lamplight here on Cambridge 105 Radio. And I'm Robert Louis Abrahamson with you for the next hour, or nearly. Now, here's what happened. Something within me recently prompted me with the idea to devote this show to the myth of Narcissus. And I've learned to trust those inner promptings. Who knows which listener might be in just the right place to get real benefit from looking at this myth. Or maybe it's me who needs to review this myth. Or maybe it's all of us who need the images brought to us through this myth. In any case, here it is. I will be attending this evening under lamplight to the myth of Narcissus. And you are invited, of course, to attend with me. So, the myth of Narcissus. Well, I remembered that I'd looked at this myth on some previous shows and found that it was way back in 2009 that I spent some time with the myth, and then again in 2011 with a whole show devoted to Narcissus. Now, I'm not going to repeat that show, but I'll be drawing on some of the things said there. Call this a new revised edition of that show. I'm so much wiser now than I was then, and so are you. And if you're an old-time listener and some of the material sounds familiar, well, we all can benefit from revisiting good material, and whether or not I can treat it well, the material itself is fine stuff and will, on its own, carry us through the discussion that follows. And before we go further, though, it might be a good idea to remind ourselves of the characteristics of myths. A myth is primarily a story, but a special kind of story. One way to see it is as what's called etiology. That is, the story of how things came to be. Thus, the myth of Noah explains how rainbows came to appear in the sky, as a sign from God that he wouldn't bring about a flood ever again. The myth of Narcissus, on its most basic level, explains the origin of the Narcissus flower. But there's more to a myth than mere explanation of origins. While science gives us explanations of how things work, which will satisfy our analytical, cause-and-effect, rational intellect, myths try to explain the world in a way that satisfies our imagination, not to mention our heart. A scientist might explain the process by which certain chemicals are transmitted between two people that excite other chemicals and hormones to create a stirring in the blood that we can recognize as sexual attraction or even love. But a myth approaches it differently. As, for instance, with the mischievous boy god Eros, or Cupid, who shoots one of his arrows at us and causes us to desire or fall in love with the next person we see. Often Eros is depicted as blindfolded, the blind bow boy, as Shakespeare called him, so that his arrows fly completely at random. But wait, a skeptic will cry, that's simply not true. It's a fiction, it's just a myth. Yes, just a myth. But then, myths never claim to be literally true, but rather true to our heartfelt experience. and falling in love or just attracted to someone else can indeed feel like we've been hit by some outside force out of our control. Sometimes it feels like someone's playing a joke on us, as we might feel if we fell madly in love with someone whose political views are entirely opposed to ours. That's the myth of Eros, the mischievous boy, delighting in creating havoc with his arrows. Or sometimes it feels we fall in love with the last person we'd ever have expected to be attracted to. There's the blind bow boy, shooting off arrows he knows not where. In other words, we might say that myths, or at least a great proportion of them, use unrealistic characters and events, some pudgy child with little wings and bow and arrow, as metaphors to describe feelings within us that can hardly be described otherwise. But we ought to check in with Joseph Campbell, one of the great masters of myth in the last century. Myths catch us, he says. They catch us because we are always caught by good stories. But they also catch us because they show us a mirror of our innermost being and reality. They resonate with this inner self so that our inner self starts resonating and, as Campbell puts it, we feel the rapture of being alive. And that, Campbell insists, is what it's all about. Myths are clues to the spiritual possibilities of the human life, he says. We're not so much concerned with the meaning of life as with just the experience of life. His message is that for all our focus on the outer value of life, the inner value, the rapture that is associated with being alive, is what it's all about. So here, let's listen to him for a few minutes in conversation with Bill Moyer. Notice how down-to-earth Campbell is, not wanting to push anything on us, but just trying to share the excitement about life that spurred him on throughout his career.
Why myths? Why should we care about myths? What do they have to do with my life?
Well, my first answer would be, well, go on, live your life. It's a good life. You don't need this. I don't believe in being interested in subjects because they're said to be important and interesting. I believe in being caught by it somehow or other. But you may find that with a proper introduction, this subject will catch you. And so what can it do for you when it does catch you? These bits of information from ancient times, which have to do with the themes that have supported man's life, built civilizations, informed religions over the millennia, have to do with deep inner problems, inner mysteries, inner thresholds of passage. And if you don't know what the guide signs are along the way, you have to work it out yourself. But once this catches you, there is always such a feeling from one or another of these traditions of information of a deep, rich, life-vivifying sort that you want to give it up.
So myths are stories of the search by men and women through the ages for meaning, for significance, to make life signify, to touch the eternal, to understand the mysterious, to find out who we are.
People say that what we're all seeking is a meaning for life. I don't think that's what we're really seeking. I think what we're seeking is an experience of being alive, so that the life experiences that we have on the purely physical plane will have resonances within that are those of our own innermost being and reality. And so that we actually feel the rapture of being alive. That's what it's all finally about, and that's what these clues help us to find within ourselves.
Myths are clues?
Myths are clues to the spiritual potentialities of the human life.
What we're capable of knowing within?
Yes.
And experiencing within?
Yes.
I liked your definition. You changed the definition of a myth from the search for meaning to the experience of meaning.
Experience.
The experience of life.
The experience of life. The mind has to do with meaning. In here, what's the meaning of a flower? That Zen story of the sermon of the Buddha, when his whole company was gathered and he simply lifted a flower. And there was only one man, Kashyapa, who gave him a sign with his eye that he understood what was said. What's the meaning of the universe? What's the meaning of a flea? It's just there, that's it. And your own meaning is that you're there. Now we are so engaged in doing things to achieve purposes of outer value that we forget that the inner value, the rapture that is associated with being alive is what it's all about.
So what inner meaning, what rapture even, can the myth of Narcissus offer us? Well, let's jump in and see if anything catches us, and perhaps come back to this question afterwards. Narcissism, as we know, is a psychological term for self-absorption, focusing entirely on oneself rather than on the people, objects, and events outside oneself. But as we'll see, our attention to the myth takes us much further. Myths, Albert Camus said, are made for the imagination to breathe life into them. And so my aim here is to take the basic story of Narcissus and try to breathe some imaginative life into it. Well, so it can come alive and catch us and animate more fully the experience of our lives. Now, Narcissus, the story tells us, was born from the rape of the wave-blue water nymph Liriope by the river deity Cephisus, who rolled her into the bed of a dark pool, then cast her up on the shingle pregnant. That was Ted Hughes' loose translation from Ovid's Metamorphoses. The rape is brutal on the human level, and on the mythic level, its swift action takes us into this mythic world where we're suddenly swept up by forces beyond our control. It's a kind of other world where we are much more often out of control than in control of our own lives. The story of Narcissus is a good example of that loss of control that leads to transformed life. The child born from this union was Narcissus. As the son of two water deities, he was destined to have some kind of connection to the unconscious, and we'll see more about that later. But the main characteristic of this child is that he was irresistibly beautiful. He had beauty that broke hearts, Ted Hughes puts it. He seemed so special that his mother took him to the prophet Tiresias to learn the child's future. Tiresias was an interesting figure since he had the unique distinction in the Greek myths of being able to see love from both sides, having been transformed at one point in his life into a woman and then back a little later to a man. He was therefore not caught in just one perspective, but saw different points of view, male and female. This presumably is what gave him his wisdom and what prompted him to speak in paradoxes, where either or neither side seems true. Liriope asks him, like any mother concerned about her child's happiness, whether her son would enjoy long years and ripe old age. Tiresias' answer in the Latin shows us an early example of the echo or mirror reflection motif that Ovid weaves through this story. Narcissus will have long life, Tiresias answers, and here we go again with some Evening Under Lamplight Latin. He'll have a long life, si se no knowerit, if he does not know himself. You can hear the echoes, si se and non knowerit. There's also a kind of pun, as though he's saying, si, si, yes, yes, and no, 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 no. Which is the answer? Who can tell? You remember the Delphic Oracle's famous advice to know thyself. But here, such self-knowledge seems fatal. Well, sort of, as we'll see. So then, what's Narcissus' choice? Long years and ripe old age, or self-knowledge? What kind of life would that ripe old age be? Ripe for what? Is life without self-knowledge worth living? Socrates didn't think so. In fact, Narcissus is in the same position as Achilles, who was promised either long years and ripe old age, or fame and glory with a young death at Troy. He chose the second. These are heroes who choose intensity of living over mere extension of life. As it turned out, though, Narcissus didn't have a choice. Self-knowledge came to him unawares, and so did his early death. But this death was actually a transformation and led to a form of intense ripeness. These paradoxes seem to permeate Narcissus' fortunes. That was Nick Drake with The Paradox of Knowing. You know that I love you, you know I don't care. You know that I see you, you know I'm not there. But the knowledge will come later for Narcissus. The story now jumps to Narcissus at age 16, when, in another paradox, puer juvenis quae videri, he seemed both boy and young man. He's on the cusp. The time of a change in life, puberty, of course. And what's going to happen to this child whose beauty broke hearts? It's at this point that Narcissus shows the symptoms of what we commonly recognize as narcissism. Here's how Ovid puts it. I use A.D. Melville's translation because it's very good and because he's a Cambridge man. And we're at Cambridge Station. Many a youth and many a girl desired him, but hard pride ruled in that delicate frame, and never a youth and never a girl could touch his haughty heart. Did you catch the reflections there? Many a youth and many a girl desired him, but never a youth and never a girl could touch him. Why? Because, Ovid says, of his hard pride, his haughty heart. But it seems that there was something wrong inside this beautiful boy, something that held him at a distance from everyone else. Was it just that he thought his beauty made him too good for everyone else? We'll have to attend to this, but but first, a bit more music. A couple of songs about hard-hearted men and their narcissistic attitude toward those who love them. First, let's start with a Rolling Stones song, Heart of Stone. Mick Jagger's voice comes on, I think, sounding a little world-weary. It's hard being a tough guy. There's been so many girls that I've known. I've made so many cry, and still I wonder why. That sounds a bit hopeful, doesn't it? He wonders why he's like this. Maybe that will lead to some sort of self-knowledge that will transform him. But immediately he gets distracted by a little girl walking towards him. She's trying so hard to please, but all he can do is cry out that she'll never break, never break, never break this heart of stone. That sounds a little over-insistent, a little defensive to me. But this little girl seems different from the others. He can't make her cry. Now he feels even more threatened. And if she starts acting sad, it will only make him glad. Nice rhyme, Mick. And in the end, with a kind of compulsive self-revelation, he warns her away from himself. You go on walking down the street. I ain't got no love. I ain't the kind to meet. And this song, with its droneful guitars and harmonies, is it a soul song, a country and western song, or a new kind of music?
This heart of stone, oh no, no, this heart of stone. What's different about her? I don't really know. No matter how I try, I just can't make her cry. Heart of stone. Oh no, no, no. This heart of stone. Don't keep on looking that same old way. If you try acting sad, you'll only make me glad. Heart of stone. Oh no, no, you'll never break this heart of stone, darling. No, no, this heart of stone. You'll never break it, darling. You won't break this heart of stone. Oh no, no, no. You better go. You better go home. Cause you'll never break this heart of stone.
You'll never break this heart of stone. No, I suppose not. It has to break from within, as we'll see. And one more narcissistic song, Dylan's It Ain't Me, Babe. I listened to many cover versions of this song, thinking it would be nice to hear someone else doing the song, but none of the versions is nasty enough, I think. This is an odd song in that the tune is actually very sweet and lyrical, though the message is a hard-hearted put-down. I suppose that continues the paradox motif that runs through the Narcissus story. We see this in the first line with its dismissive, "Go away from my window." What's she been doing? Staring up at his window, heart-struck, hoping to catch a glimpse of him, or to have him catch a glimpse of her down there in the street? Go away from my window. But then he allows her to leave at your own chosen speed. Is that kindness? Please, by all means, take your choice of speeds for leaving. Or even more of a put-down. I don't really care how fast or how slow you choose to leave, girl, as long as you just go away. In some ways, this is not a song typical of Narcissus, because this singer knows himself as Narcissus by definition at this point does not. I'm not the one you want, babe. I'm not the one you need. You say you're looking for someone never weak but always strong to protect you and defend you whether you are right or wrong, someone to open each and every door, but it ain't me, babe. It ain't me you're looking for, babe. You have to get the right kind of scorn in that word, babe. Go melt back into the night, babe. Everything inside is made of stone. There it is, that heart of stone. And like the Rolling Stones song, he knows it. There's nothing in here moving, he says. But then he adds, and anyway, I'm not alone. Oh, really? Well, who's with this man of stone? Maybe some demon living inside him, keeping him company. Or maybe just someone or something there with him, much more important than this babe hanging around outside his window. Or maybe we can turn the whole thing around. Instead of, it ain't me you're looking for, let's try, it ain't me you're looking for. You're not the one looking for the real me. I'm the one looking for the real me. I've discovered all the things I'm not, and I'm just ready to find out who I really am. Come back when I find him. He'll welcome you, I know it.
Go away from my window. Leave at your own chosen speed. I'm not the one you want, babe. I'm not the one you need. You say you're looking for someone who's never weak but always strong, to protect you and defend you whether you are right or wrong. Someone to open each and every door, but it ain't me, babe. No, 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 it ain't me, babe. It ain't me you're looking for, babe. Go lightly from the ledge, babe. Go lightly on the ground. I'm not the one you want, babe. I will only let you down. You say you're looking for someone who promised never to part. Someone to close his eyes for you. Someone to close his heart. Someone who will die for you and more. But it ain't me, babe. No, 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 it ain't me, babe. It ain't me you're looking for, babe. Thank you. go melt back in the night. Everything inside is made of stone. There's nothing in here moving, and anyway I'm not alone. You say you're looking for someone who'll pick you up each time you fall, to gather flowers constantly, and to come each time you call. A lover for your life and nothing more, but it ain't me, babe. No, 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 it ain't me, babe. It ain't me you're looking for, babe.
Go melt back in the night. Now, is that a tender line or is it really very dismissive? It's both. We're dealing with paradoxes, remember. And that was Bob Dylan and It Ain't Me, Babe. And this, as you know, is Evening Under Lamplight on Cambridge 105 Radio with your host, Robert Louis Abrahamson. We're trying to bring some light onto the Narcissus myth, or take some light from that myth.
When the day comes to an end, he invites you to attend Evening Under Lamplight. It's Cambridge 105 Radio.
Thank you, Neil Henry. And back to Narcissus. Why did this irresistibly beautiful adolescent boy turn everyone away? I think it was like this. Narcissus would not allow anyone to touch him because he distrusted them. They wanted him, but he couldn't see the point. Why me? Oh, Narcissus, you're so beautiful. Your beauty is breaking my heart, they'd cry. But not perceiving his own beauty, he couldn't see what they were talking about and thought they're just trying to flatter him and take advantage of him. So his heart wasn't really proud, though it was hard, and he was not really haughty, just immature, unaware of his self. And then the complication to the story. We focus in on one woman, a nymph, who frequented the hills where Narcissus would go to hunt. Hunting being the activity in Greek myths, followed by those who do not want to get involved with love or sex. This nymph was called Echo, and she suffered under a severe curse. Here's what happened. For whatever reason, she took on the role of Jove's accomplice. So when Jove, the king of the gods, when Jove would be off in the woods having his way with some local nymph, Echo would stand on guard in case Jove's wife Juno showed up, and if Juno did show up, Echo would engage her in conversation. Nice hairdo today, Your Majesty, and that pin you're holding your gown up, it's adorable, it's so marvelously crafted. Who made it for you? And then when Echo knew that Jove was finished, it never took him long and he never lingered, and when she knew that the nymph had left, Echo would back off and let Juno go on her way now the coast was clear. Juno was no fool, though, and soon saw what Echo was up to and punished her with the curse of never being able to speak herself, but only to repeat the final words of what someone else was saying. Echo, you see, had become an echo. But she was also a woman in the flesh and susceptible to the intense appeal of Narcissus' beauty. She saw Narcissus and fell uncontrollably in love. But she couldn't tell him her love. She couldn't tell him anything until he spoke to her first. Ovid has a lot of fun with this, playing with the reflections and echoes. She followed him through the woods, growing more enamored the longer she looked at him. Narcissus realized that he'd become lost, and he called out for his friends. Now that he spoke, Echo was finally able to speak back. Here's Melville's translation again. He called out, "Anyone here?" And Echo answered, "Here." Amazed, he looked all around and, raising his voice, called, "Come this way!" And Echo called, "This way!" He looked behind, and no one coming, shouted, "Why run away?" and heard his words again. He stopped and, cheated by the answering voice, called, "Join me here!" And she, never more glad to give her answer, answered, "Join me here!" Actually, in Latin, Narcissus says, "Coiamus," which can mean, "let's meet." But when Echo repeats the word, it takes on the sexual sense of "let's join up." Narcissus gave her just the word she was dying to say to him. So Echo now ran out from the wood to throw her longing arms around his neck. He bolted, shouting, "Keep your arms from me! Be off! I'll die before I yield to you." And all she answered was, "I yield to you." Ted Hughes elaborates this final exchange. He has Narcissus say, No, I would sooner be dead than let you touch me." Echo collapsed in sobs as her voice lurched among the mountains. "Touch me, touch me, touch me, touch me, touch me." It's not a happy ending for Echo. Rejected by Narcissus, she pined until her body wasted away and she became just a disembodied voice, the Echo as we know today. This disembodiment is another symbol, perhaps, of the same problem we have seen in Narcissus. He did not know himself. He was running around unconnected to his deep beauty. The curse on Echo was a similar kind of thing. Juno ensured that she would never be able to connect with her true self, or at least express it, but only reflect other people. She became like those adolescents who never act from their true selves, not having any idea what their true selves are, but fashion their actions and their appearance and even things like their tone of voice on whatever everyone else is doing. They become only echoes, able to express only what someone else has expressed first. If they persist like this, their true self withers away and they grow up to be an adult who just does what is expected, never in touch with anything original or true. Well, let's stop for a minute to hear an interesting poem connected with echoes. It's an anonymous little poem from the English Civil War, predicting dire consequences for London now that political factions, here called siding, now that they have forced King Charles to leave London. The poem is called "London, Sad London, An Echo."
What wants thee that thou art in this sad taking?
A king.
What made him first remove hence his residing?
Siding.
Did any here deny him satisfaction?
Faction.
Tell me whereon this strength of faction lies.
On lies.
What didst thou do when the king left Parliament?
Lament.
What terms wouldst give to gain his company?
Any.
But how wouldst serve him with thy best endeavour?
Ever.
What wouldst thou do if here thou couldst behold him?
Hold him.
But if he comes not, what becomes of London?
Undone.
There's a bit from Les Éclairs de Musique, playing the second movement from Lotti's Concerto in Sol Maggiore, with an echo effect between the recorder and violin. But back to our story, where we are approaching the climax. What became of Narcissus? One of his rejected lovers cursed him, let him fall in love with someone who rejects him as he has rejected us. The goddess Nemesis, the personification of retribution, heard and answered this prayer. It was just what Narcissus needed, a profound shock to throw him out of his immature position and help him see things in a new way. Nemesis seems at first an enemy, but she shakes us up for our own good. You'll see what I mean. In most myths and fairy tales, a curse can easily become transformed into a blessing. The presence of the goddess shows us that some sort of transformation can take place. Now, one day, while out hunting, as usual, Narcissus found himself in a secluded grove where no one had ever set foot before, and discovered there a sacred pool of water. There was a pool, limpid and silvery, whither no shepherd came, nor any herd, nor mountain goat, and never bird, nor beast, nor falling branch disturbed its shining peace. Grass grew around it, by the water fed, and trees to shield it from the warming sun. These details tell us that this was a holy place, where things can turn right around for us. Now, thirsty, Narcissus stooped down to drink from the pool there, but suddenly he caught sight of his own reflection and fell immediately in love with the image. Of course he did. His beauty was irresistible, remember? We're often told to avoid looking at ourselves in the mirror. It just feeds vanity. You won't find mirrors in monasteries or convents, for instance. But looking in the mirror can be a good thing, too. After all, it's essential that we know ourselves. And so what happened to Narcissus when he looked into the sacred mirror of that pool of water? Both his parents, you recall, were water deities, and so here's Narcissus connecting with his deep roots. And on a symbolic level, water is frequently a symbol for our unconscious. So the myth is telling us that this beautiful, unselfconscious boy looks for the first time deep within himself. And there he finds his true beauty. We're no longer talking about physical beauty, but that inner beauty we all possess, though few of us dare to look or acknowledge it. Only myths and fairy tales tell us of this. But just as he refused to let anyone touch him, so he could not touch this image he was in love with. If he reached out to touch the face in the water would ripple and the face disappear. If he moved back, the face too moved back. Here's Melville again translating Ovid's use of mirrors and reflections and echoes. All he admires that all admire in him, himself he longs for, longs unwittingly. Praising is praised, desiring is desired, and love he kindles while with love he burns. This is the dark night of Narcissus' soul, the confusion and pain as he approaches his big transformation. Let's hear Narcissus' lover's complaint to his own reflection in Ted Hughes' version now. "Who are you?" he says to the image. "Who are you? Come out, come up onto the land. I never saw beauty to compare with yours. Oh, why do you always dodge away at the last moment and leave me with my arms full of nothing but water and the memory of an image? It cannot be my ugliness or my age that repels you, if all the nymphs are so crazy about me. Your face is full of love as your eyes look into my eyes. I see it and my hope shakes me. I stretch my arms to you. You stretch yours as eagerly to me. You laugh when I laugh. I have watched your tears through my tears. When I tell you my love, I see your lips seem to tell me yours, though I cannot hear it. You are me. Now I see that. I see through my own reflection. But it is too late. I am in love with myself. I torture myself. What am I doing, loving or being loved? What can my courtship gain? What I want, I am. But being all that I long for, that is my destitution. Why can't I get apart from my body? This is a new kind of lover's prayer, to wish himself apart from the one he loves. And so the story comes to its end. Narcissus cannot draw himself away from his reflection and pines away looking into the water. He dies, and in death is transformed into a flower. The flower we know as the Narcissus, which bends its head as though looking into the water to see its reflection. Narcissus' transformation into a flower is, in this sense, a great fulfillment. What is a flower, after all, but a thing of beauty that displays its beauty for everyone to see? Flowers do not run from their admirers as Narcissus used to do. And now, once he has discovered his own beauty and learns to love it, he's free to let everyone come and admire him. His soul has blossomed. What more appropriate piece to follow the Narcissus story than Debussy's Reflets dans l'eau, Reflections in the Water, played here by Vlado Perlmutter. So there we are. Narcissus has finally seen his own deep beauty. And what about Tiresias' prophecy? Remember that from the beginning of the story? Narcissus will have long life, si se non innoverit, if he does not know himself. Perhaps we can resolve the paradox now. What kind of long life would Narcissus have had? A long life, safe from other people, whom he kept at bay, a lonely life, cut off from all beauty, his own and others. But he came to know himself, that is, to know his own deep beauty, and at that moment his old self died. His long life of isolation fell away, and he was transformed into his new life, knowing himself and sharing himself like, of course, like a flower. After all, as we're told, whosoever loses his or her life will save it. Transform it is more like it. How well might this myth apply itself to our own individual modern lives? The question might be rephrased to ask how or when can we come to see our own true beauty? Narcissus discovered his only once he entered that sacred space with the sacred pool. And what made that space sacred? It was a place, you'll recall, where no one had ever entered before. Now, I asked myself where we might be able to find such a place for ourselves in this crowded world, and it suddenly occurred to me that the place where no one has ever been before is right here in front of us. It is this present moment. No one has ever been here before. This present moment is unique in the truest sense of the word, and that's what makes it sacred, the power of now. When we become present to the moment, letting go thoughts of past and future, becoming as still as that reflective pool, perhaps it's only in that moment that we can at last perceive, intuit might be a better word, at last intuit our true self, our true beauty. But alas, we cannot grasp this vision of ourselves. Narcissus tried to reach out and embrace and hold fast this beautiful image of himself, but, of course, was frustrated over and over. We're given there a metaphor for the way our inner beauty is not something we can grasp hold of. We cannot intellectualize it or even define it. We just have to perceive it in the moments of reflective stillness. This moment of stillness can, of course, be a moment of quiet meditation, but it can also be a time of activity if we have entered fully into that moment with a deep intensity, as when we're being creative or engaged in some sport we love. And then if we can at the same time become a witness of what we are doing, both in and out of the game, as Whitman says, then we might be able to feel that deep self resonating within us. Maybe. And something in us dies at that moment, and something else blossoms. Maybe that flower fades. Maybe we need to keep returning to that still pool in the sacred space of the moment. Maybe, that is, we are asked to reenact the Narcissus myth over and over throughout our lives. How does this resonate with you? Has it, in Campbell's words, caught you? Has it given you some imagery that reflects your own experience of living? Play around with the mythic story. Identify the echoes in your life, the reflections and the paradoxes, and maybe the images from this story will help you see these things more clearly and help you see the inner value of your life and live more rapturously with your experience of living. Yeah, yes, all these things. Over to you, however you want to take any of this. I've done my bit as the medium, helping to bring them across the airwaves for you. And now, like a flower at the end of the day, I'll fold myself up and close the show. Evening Under Lamplight on Cambridge 105 Radio. Robert Louis Abrahamson thanking you and looking forward to our next meeting in a fortnight. And we'll close appropriately with Benjamin Britten's Narcissus from his 6 Metamorphoses after Ovid. See you next time.